Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
The enemy is the same, but the war on drugs is changing. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Why are you asking me this battery of questions?
30 more seconds. I'm almost done. About 2 minutes more of drilling.
Because we don't know where you come, and we don't know where you're going to go after this.
You know, it just sort of adds like a level of stress to something that's already stressful.
When we're looking for the needle in the haystack, the high pathogenic avian influenza virus.
And every time I see that, I think, like, wow, that didn't exist before we made that happen.
On today's show, we're in the middle of a heroin epidemic. How is that changing drug policy, policing, addiction research, anti-drug messaging? First up, let's head right into the eye of this storm, prescription painkillers and heroin. Use has been skyrocketing and it's had a massive toll. Fatal overdoses from these substances have hit a record high. 25,000 people died in the U.S. in 2014. First responders, law enforcement, and even some school nurses now carry a weapon to combat overdoses, naloxone, which many people refer to by its brand name, which is Narcan. If it's administered soon enough, it can reverse an overdose on the spot.
Pretty much on my third day of working here at the police department, I was able to save my first life using Narcan provided by the police department.
This is Officer Tyrell Bagby with the Camden County Police Department in New Jersey. The memory he has of saving this man's life is really vivid. The man's family was there watching, and he was really nervous.
As soon as I arrived on scene, the male's face was completely blue, the lips were blue. I didn't see any chest rise, no breathing, and as soon as I administered the first dose of Narcan, I see the color starting to come back, so I knew that what I was doing was working.
Since then, Bagby has used Narcan more than a dozen times, and when he's out on patrol driving around, he's always recalling different incidents.
It was on a summer day, I believe, last year, matter of fact. The individual had overdosed right here next to multiple parked cars.
Everybody we talk to who uses the overdose antidote says having it available at the right time, at the right place, has a huge impact. It saves lives. But then what? A person just almost died. They've been revived. What happens after that? Alana Gordon takes it from here.
Naloxone's power comes from its ability to seep in those receptors in your brain where the heroin's overloading your system and causing an overdose. It blocks that. It immediately reverses everything. And the effect can be abrupt.
I felt horrible, like worse than I had ever felt in my life. My body had ached. I was shivering. I was cold, but I was sweating. I was crying. Like, I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how to act. And I felt desperate.
This is Holly Platts. She's 28, has wavy strawberry blonde hair and black rimmed glasses. She overdosed in Philly last June for the very first time. It was outside near railroad tracks.
I was homeless, you know, so I wasn't eating very well. You know, my body was drained. It was the middle of the summer. I wasn't hydrated.
She remembers the first thought that ran through her mind when she came to.
Like, wow, I can't believe, you know, I almost lost my life.
For Platts and others, coming face to face with death can be a moment of reckoning. Not always. Addiction's complicated. Depending on how much drugs are in a person's system and the way Narcan's administered, a person can feel like they're in immediate withdrawal, confused, agitated, angry. Many first responders see people walk away afterwards, even though the protocol is to take them to the hospital. For Holly Platts, who's in recovery now, paramedics did take her to the ER for observation. Typically, once there, a person's under watch for about an hour and a half. Narcan blocks any sort of high for at least 30 minutes and then starts to wear off. Platts recalls in that haze of nearly dying, she wanted help. She asked for it. They kept her overnight. She felt like she couldn't move. But the next day, for a host of factors, one being her insurance, She says there wasn't anywhere for her to go. No plan.
So when I had left the hospital, the only thing I could think of to feel better was to go get high. You know, I just couldn't take the pain anymore, the suffering. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It's a horrible feeling.
Over the next few months, Glatz OD'd several more times. Each of those times, Narcan brought her back. In general, people who overdose are at higher risk for overdosing again. Glatz stopped asking for help in those moments after. She thought about it, but thought about what had happened in that situation before.
My intent was never to hurt myself or ultimately die, but unfortunately, you know, I came very close quite a few times.
Community trainings stress the importance of staying with someone who's just been revived with Narcan. ERs will watch people for a few hours. But beyond that, the plan for those who survive an overdose is unclear.
I'm frustrated by the situation.
This is Dr. Priya Mamman. She's a professor of emergency medicine at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. Dr. Mamman says the hospital doesn't track what happens to people after a non-fatal overdose, but she's not surprised by Pratt's experience.
Because to get somebody into treatment or even sort of make the linkage is amazingly complex. It's very, very different than, you know, someone with diabetes or someone has these very clear medical issues.
She says psychiatric crisis centers are better equipped for this. Social workers in the hospital can help. But she's found it's beyond her scope to make the needed connections.
We have a packet of information of detox and rehab centers around the city, which I find just so, like, unpowerful to be like, here you go, here's a set of papers. I hope you read them. I hope you choose one. I hope you go and call them.
And even if someone calls for help, she knows a lot of places simply won't have room. Now, to be clear, health researchers cannot stress enough the benefits of Narcan. Tracy Green is one of them. She teaches at Brown Medical School in Rhode Island. She also directs the Injury Prevention Center at Boston Medical Center. She says Narcan, in combination with policies that legally protect people in overdose situations, is increasing 911 calls in her area and those seeking immediate help, which is why she's also seeing more and more places starting to really look into this next step, the what happens right after someone gets hit with naloxone.
I think what we're seeing is a real rebirth of what can we think about, what can we use, and what we understand about how do we treat addiction better with this opportunity.
In most places, non-fatal overdoses aren't reportable, so there's not much overall tracking of what happens. Rhode Island recently changed that and is just beginning to collect data. And they're testing out an idea that came out of the recovery community, on-call recovery specialists who essentially respond within minutes to an emergency department overdose. They offer resources, they follow up, and unlike general medical staff, they also have a shared experience. It's a peer-to-peer model. New Jersey just launched a similar approach this past month. Joe Coronado is the prosecutor in Ocean County, the first place in the state to have law enforcement carry naloxone. They're now participating in this new project.
You need somebody who is actually skilled in this area, and the recovery coaches are people who've walked the walk, meaning they're individuals that have had a substance abuse problem who have now overcome that problem and are now working with other people.
Experiments in other states like Massachusetts have involved everything from better training medical staff to having a first responder who initially saved someone follow up with them that same day. A program in Connecticut is experimenting with starting people on buprenorphine, often preferred over methadone, right out of the ER. Forced ER observation or treatment has been thrown out there on the other extreme. Pennsylvania's Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs recently called on counties to come up with a, quote, warm handoff policy for individuals who survived a recent overdose. And then there are people who aren't waiting for any of this.
All right, you're doing good. Bye. Hello.
Carol Rostisher is 52 years old. She's from Philly. She carries Narcan in her purse and drives around in a maroon 98 Toyota Corolla all day, crisscrossing throughout the city, connecting and following up with people who are homeless, in active addiction, in and out of treatment, and the ER. I guess you could call her an informal navigator of sorts, just meeting people where they're at.
Right now, we're heading out to get someone. They're in a recovery house, state-funded for 90 days. They're going to be leaving there and going into a recovery house where they have to pay now. So they're working and starting the recovery process. Hello.
Rastisher used to be a legal assistant, but this has turned into her full-time thing. She has a personal stake in it. Narcan's saved her own kid's life.
My son was out in the streets and active addiction. And going to find him, I would see other lost souls, and I just felt so horrible. Like, people would drive by them, ignore their existence, and I couldn't do it.
Turn right onto Frankfurt Avenue.
On a recent afternoon, she picks up Salvatore Moro.
Sal, this is your bag. Here, honey.
They first met when he was homeless. She was passing out food to people.
I went in November 20th.
Well, that's good. I didn't
he gets in the back seat. She hands him some toiletries.
And I got your razors and shaving cream.
Moro is 27, tall, skinny, has hazel eyes and a boyish face. But at the same time, it seems worn from years of drug use. He's missing part of a front tooth. Moro says naloxone has brought him back a lot, starting with his very first hit.
First time I did heroin, I shot it up and I overdosed right away. On my birthday, January 24th, 2011. Yeah, I was in Bucks County at my dad's and my mom's house.
He says since that first overdose, naloxone has saved his life over a dozen times.
It's more than an average person, yeah.
And look at him. He's worth it, though, isn't he? Without it, he wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have Sal. Right? And Sal's moving forward, making strides.
The last time he overdosed was over 6 months ago. Rastisher drops him off at a recovery house, where he's now figuring out the more long-term what's next questions. Like, what about a job? Permanent housing?
All right. I love you.
Yes, ma'am.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about the heroin epidemic and the changing war on drugs. And now we're going to take a look at how police departments are dealing with this issue. Last year, the police chief of Gloucester, Massachusetts, made an unusual offer on his department's Facebook page. Heroin addicts who come voluntarily to the police station will not get arrested. They'll get help. The post went viral and led to the creation of the Gloucester Angel Program, in which the police help addicts find drug treatment options. The Gloucester effort has gotten national press, and it spread to dozens of other police departments around the country. Reporter Karen Brown spent time with one New England police chief who was inspired by this example, though he didn't quite get the same results.
All right, I'll be right around front and I'll pick you up.
All right, super.
All right.
Police Chief Chip Dodge knows I want to ride in a police cruiser, so he agrees to take me on a tour of Turner's Falls, a western Massachusetts town of 5,000 people in his jurisdiction. When I hop into one of his officers' marked cars, we notice a pamphlet on opiate addiction tucked above the visor.
And so to see that makes me pleased to know that it's not stuffed away in a glove box somewhere, you know.
Turner's Falls, like many rural towns in New England, has seen a huge spike in heroin use over the past decade. The epidemic was set off, experts say, by a boom in painkiller prescriptions. People often start with opiate pills, get addicted to the high, and move on to heroin, which is cheaper and easier to get.
This was a huge drug house right here.
Chief Dodge drives by an old Victorian in the downtown.
The Board of Health went in there and they just condemned the building.
He waves to a couple of older women walking their dogs, goes past a backyard where a toddler once stepped on a used heroin needle, and drives slowly around a man who is walking obliviously down the middle of the road.
No, we must be pretty tough around here if they'll walk down a road like that.
It's against this backdrop of familiarity and economic struggle that Dodge hopes to upend the traditional relationship between police and drug users.
When I first started as a police officer in 1992, when I thought of heroin, I thought of major crime. You knew it was a felony. You knew it was really bad.
Back then, if officers came across someone with heroin on them,
we would have arrested them for possession of heroin.
And it wasn't that common. But by 2014, 2 years after Dodge became chief, the Massachusetts governor declared heroin addiction a state emergency. Nationally, the number of addicts had doubled over a decade. Young people were dying regularly from overdoses. Dodge started to go to regional trainings on the opioid crisis, meeting doctors and social workers who convinced him addiction is a disease.
Also, in this position, I think people tend to trust you a little more and they share a little bit more information with you. I've had people come in and sit down and talk to me wanting to know how to get help, and I never would have guessed in a million years that those people were addicted.
Last summer, Dodge posted a message to the police department's Facebook page. He said anyone addicted to opiates, be it pills or heroin, can drop off their drugs at the station, no questions asked, and get help kicking their habit. They would not get arrested. He was borrowing directly from a similar post by Gloucester Police Chief Leonard Campanello. But Dodge says his fleet of 23 officers didn't immediately buy into this kinder, gentler police force.
I'm not going to lie. When I first started introducing this to some of the officers saying we're going to try to get people help, I got some pretty funny looks.
Because it kind of goes against everything that a cop is taught. You break the law, you go to jail.
Sergeant Leon Laster is a 17-year veteran of the police force in Turner's Falls, most of that in drug enforcement. He's made arrests for cocaine, crack, heroin, not to mention property or violent crime that can go along with the drug trade.
Cops don't like change. I mean, and when I say that, what I mean is a lot of things change. It's just not really a great time to be cops. And this is one more thing where it's like, okay, are they tying our hands where we can't do our job now? What is this about? So it was new to us.
But Laster, who's wearing a Mike Tyson t-shirt, it's his day off, he says the local police culture has become more empathetic under Dodge's leadership, at least towards addicts.
When you actually sit back and look, it's a great idea. My only concern is, did we have services in place before we started advertising?
It's this question of access, more than police attitudes, that Chief Dodge finds frustrating.
When somebody does have a problem, we want to be able to call up and get them a bed. Right now, all I can do is give them a whole bunch of ideas.
On the other side of Massachusetts, Gloucester, a coastal town of about 30,000 people, reports getting 400 addicts into treatment in the past year. But Dodge says his department has been much less successful. Since there are so few treatment options in this mostly rural county, he says all they can really offer is a ride to the emergency room.
If it was my family member, I would drive them right to Gloucester PD and pull in and say help, because they have the resources. They have the plan.
He wouldn't be the only one. Gloucester's police chief, Leonard Campanello, says 60 to 70% of the addicts asking his department for help come from outside the city and some outside the state. So he set up a nonprofit to help other police departments launch similar programs around the country. 60 have signed up so far. And despite Chief Dodge's experience,
there are plenty of treatment options out there. It's a matter of connecting people with that.
And knowing where to look.
I think you have to start looking outside of your own community. I mean, we don't place anybody in Gloucester. We don't have a facility. We have an emergency room. We never take anyone there.
Campanello says he's willing to help Dodge find treatment centers closer to Turner's Falls. But for now, Dodge says he's still working on building trust between addicts and police.
Station 253-25.
251 dispatch. I'll be on walkie. Female.
On our ride through town, Dodge comes upon a woman stumbling along a busy road, apparently intoxicated from something.
Hi, how are you? You okay?
She tells him she's coming off drugs from the dentist and doesn't need help. A quick call to the station reveals she's had many run-ins with police, but Dodge instructs an officer to just wait with her until a friend picks her up. A few years ago, he says, this might have been a much tenser interaction.
We do arrest, don't get me wrong, especially large amounts that, you know, you're the dealer or whatever. We don't really have a whole lot of sympathy for that person. But we do look into the circumstances a little more. If you find somebody with some heroin or something, we like to know the story. Why?
Compassionate police or not, Dodge says the opioid crisis is getting worse. His officers respond to at least one overdose a month. And while he won't arrest anyone asking for help, he has noticed that sometimes the only thing that makes an addict want to stop using is time in jail. For The Pulse, I'm Karen Brown.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show is about addiction and the changing war on drugs, and you can find our podcast on iTunes. Even considering a gentler approach to policing, getting people into treatment rather than jail cells, was unimaginable during the last major drug epidemic that faced this country. Todd Bookman reports.
During the mid-1980s, Robert Stuttman led the New York field office for the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. His days were spent cultivating informants and going after large-scale narcotics traffickers, mostly cocaine, heroin, and marijuana.
And I will never forget the day in late September of 1985. I was having a staff meeting in my office. And it was a big office, 500, 600 cops and agents, right? The supervisor walked into the meeting, and I'll never forget his words. He said, "Boss, we're finding vials of this shit all over Harlem. They call it crack, and we have no idea what it is."
Within a few years, there would be no escaping crack's impact. Local TV news filled with images of small plastic vials and drug-ravaged bodies, of guns and dealers. There were fears of a generation being lost to crack babies. Here's President Ronald Reagan addressing the nation in 1986.
"Today, there's a new epidemic. Smokable cocaine, otherwise known as crack. It is an explosively destructive and often lethal substance which is crushing its users. It is an uncontrolled fire."
An uncontrolled fire, except crack wasn't sweeping everywhere. It was mainly confined to inner cities and predominantly black communities, where the violence exploded.
"My name is Martha Overall. I'm the priest of St. Anne's Episcopal Church in the Mott Haven neighborhood of the South Bronx."
Tell me a little bit about this neighborhood.
"Financially, this is the poorest part of the poorest congressional district in the entire United States. Spiritually, it's full of wonderful people."
Reverend Overall is a slim, tall woman, formal in her religious dress. She remembers crack's arrival in this community, its onslaught on the people.
"It was this overwhelming flood of really cheap, really potent drugs. And, you know, the person who would take it was not really in charge of themselves because it was the drug taking over them. So it was an incredibly emotionally devastating period."
Overall says the Mott Haven neighborhood has never fully recovered from the epidemic. Part of those lingering scars were caused by the criminal justice system's aggressive response to crack. Mandatory minimums and far harsher sentences than those applied to cocaine helped swell the prison population and break apart families. At the time, treatment wasn't much part of the conversation. This was the war on drugs. And in war, there is no room for leniency.
"Those people belong in jail."
This is New York City's mayor in the 1980s, Democrat Ed Koch.
"Those people who are users, I have no sympathy for them."
That lack of patience for crack users stands in stark contrast to how politicians and police are tackling and talking about heroin, the current national epidemic. And that change of course isn't lost on Echo Yanka, a professor at Cardozo Law School in Manhattan.
"One thing people cannot fail to notice has been the litany of presidential candidates, and let me be quick to add, Republican presidential candidates who've spent two generations speaking about being tough on drugs, suddenly saying,
and we're going to work, and we're going to work really hard to get those people that are so addicted off the habit. We're going to work like hell to take care of the situation. It's a huge problem."
Stunning turnaround of humanization, of reaching out, of undermining blameworthiness, and of talking about drugs as a medical problem and a public health problem rather than a sign of pathology and weakness within a community.
It's impossible to miss the 180-degree shift in how we think about a population consumed by drugs. But is it the drug that's driving this change in attitude or the population? Yanka wrote in the New York Times recently about the role of race in addiction response and the disparities between 1980s crack, perceived as a black drug, and today's heroin epidemic, predominantly used by whites.
"It's fair for people to ask, where was this compassion when it was the African-American community being attacked by addiction?"
There are likely other factors at play besides race in today's new attitude towards substance abuse. For starters, addiction researchers and those on the front lines have been pushing for reforms for decades, and our understanding of what causes addiction and what can best treat it are clearer today. But Yanka writes about feeling a bittersweet sting over the new approach and the efforts to support rather than incarcerate. It was politically safe to just say no to poor black people. But when the user looks like the politician that represents him, it's harder to be severe.
But there's something deep about the same, which is to say, looking at the children or looking at young black mothers, people saw welfare queens and something wrong with them. Now people say, my God, that could be my child, when they look at the young white faces. And parents are being encouraged to speak at funerals about how their child got addicted, rather than being shamed into hiding whether or not their child struggled with drugs.
To be clear, Yanka isn't calling for today's generation of users to suffer the same fate as those from 30 years ago. And he says this shouldn't be about guilt over historical wrongs. His argument is that the lessons we can learn from the two epidemics can help shape our approach to other public health challenges and criminal justice reforms in minority communities. He wants us to learn from our, quote, meanest moments and answer our crises, no matter what neighborhood they impact, with greater humanity. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and Todd just mentioned this in his piece. Researchers have gained a lot of ground in the decades since the crack epidemic. They now better understand the brain mechanisms that are related to addiction. There are new medications and therapy approaches, and with the Affordable Care Act, treatment has become more widely covered by insurance companies. I tracked down longtime addiction researcher Tom McLellan in Florida to discuss these changes. He was briefly the deputy drug czar for the Obama administration, but he says Washington was not for him. I asked Tom where things stand with funding for addiction research.
That's still a problem. The National Institute on Drug Abuse gets approximately $1 billion a year, and the National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse gets approximately $750 million a year. That's quite a bit of money, I know. But it is very low compared to cancer, heart disease, diabetes, many of the other illnesses.
There is a report underway by the Surgeon General on addiction, the first ever. What do you think that will accomplish? What is it about?
Well, I think it's going to be pivotal. This, as you say, will be the first time the Surgeon General has ever examined this, and that says a lot. It says the public has finally caught up, and it says, without question, this is a public health issue. It's not a moral issue. It's not just a criminal justice issue. So right away, that changes things. But more than anything else, I think we have the tools to prevent, to intervene early, and to treat very effectively substance use disorders. They've rarely been applied. I think more than any other reason is the way the public has seen it. They've not seen it as a public health issue. I think the Surgeon General's report will do a lot to change it, as it did with smoking 50 years ago.
What is included in a Surgeon General's report typically, and how is it received? How is it used?
Well, it's a call to action for all of the agencies in the federal government that would be involved in health care. But more than that, it's a call to health groups, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, to health authorities at the state and local level, and to the public at large to get involved in this.
And Tom, are you involved in this report?
I am involved in it. I can't talk much about it because it's still embargoed, but I'm quite proud to be part of it. I think it's going to be very, very good.
What did it take to get to this point? Did it take another massive drug epidemic like the one we're experiencing right now?
I have talked with the Surgeon General, and yes, this still young physician was very aware of the methamphetamine and then prescription opioid and now heroin epidemics that are facing the country. But more than anything else, what was compelling to him as a young physician in training was that almost every problem that he encountered, he would find underlying substance use, alcohol use, marijuana use, and it had not been addressed in his education. It had not been addressed in his training. So when he became Surgeon General, he picked this issue of all the things he might have gone after.
And Tom, it seems like the political
winds have changed as well, in general, on both sides.
Oh, my God. I never imagined that there would be a state of the union address for a state like Vermont, where the entire state of the state address was dedicated to one problem, opioid abuse. That happened this year. You have Republican and Democratic candidates with platform positions now on the substance use problem, and all of them are talking about combined public health as well as public safety approaches. I think that the level of debate has elevated remarkably.
You've been in this for decades. You had a brief stint in Washington. Did you ever think you would see the day?
No, I didn't, to be perfectly honest. I never did. When I started in Washington, there was no appetite for the topic at all. It was considered the third rail of American politics. You just don't discuss drug use. It's a certain way of never getting elected. Those days are happily behind us.
Tom McLellan is the chairman of the board for the Treatment Research Institute. We're talking about the changing war on drugs today, and this war has been accompanied by many rallying cries and slogans. Just say no. This is your brain on drugs. We asked you which anti-drug messages you remember the most, and to record those recollections and email them to us, here's Bill Bender of Philadelphia.
Hey, Mike, the one anti-drug ad that I remember most from my childhood in, I guess it was the mid-80s, late 80s, other than the eggs in the frying pan one, was the ad where the kid is laying on his bed rocking out and air drumming, and he has his headphones on, and the dad walks in. The dad's like, you know, where did you get this? You know, who taught you how to use this? And the kid's like, but dad, and he's fine. I learned it from watching you.
I remember that one, Bill. And then I remember the one where the girl smashes up her whole kitchen. I think that was the sequel to the egg in the frying pan one. But I never learned any songs related to drug use.
Hi, my name is Addie Weirich, and I'm recording this in my dorm room at NYU in New York City. So as far as drug campaigns go, there's one very specific one that was drilled into our heads when I was a middle schooler. There was a song. D, I won't do drugs. A, won't have an attitude. R, I will respect myself. E, I will educate me now. And it was just weird. We always just thought the grammar on I will educate me now was weird because it was talking about education. But we were using poor grammar.
Still pretty early in the morning for a college student. Addie also said that some of her peers wore their DARE shirts ironically while smoking cigarettes or pot. And that sometimes happens. A public service announcement turns into a joke or a meme. So how do you find the right button to push to get kids to think differently? Tanya English reports.
Tell them you need to pee or tell them you can't because you'll get in trouble with your coach. Any excuse will do. If someone offers you drugs, John Hampton says that's the one time you have permission to lie.
You don't have to be mad. You don't have to ask them, what is it? You don't have to ask them, why are you asking me this? I'm going to tell your mom or none of that stuff. Tell them you'll be right back and walk away.
Hampton is a community educator in Delaware and travels the state talking to kids. At an after-school assembly in Wilmington, his audience is 9, 10, and 11-year-olds. He tells them that taking drugs is like pulling from a deck of cards. An overdose is a king or a queen.
But if you get lucky and pull a couple twos messing with drugs, what happens is you start thinking you're bulletproof and nothing's going to happen. That's what gets a lot of people in trouble. They get lucky a couple times.
So he teaches the students 10 different ways to say no the first time. Hampton plays the role of a friend or a drug dealer.
Y'all want some drugs?
No!
And the kids take turns practicing their refusal skills. A 9-year-old wearing glasses and a pink and purple bracelet comes up with some of the most creative answers for peer pressure.
I'm Asaya DeWitt. I'm in fourth grade at Claymont Elementary School.
First, she blames her parents.
No, actually, my mom just texted me I have to go help her with my sister.
Then Asaya says she's got to be somewhere.
I have to go practice my dance routine.
Tens of millions of state and federal drug prevention dollars are invested in school and community programs like this one.
If y'all remember nothing else, remember the funny-looking bald-headed guy with the grandest beard, and he kept walking away. Do that.
Kids get basic information and practice decision-making. Sitting in the back of the room with my jaded adult self, though, John Hampton's approach seems preachy.
I want y'all to say, I
refuse
to be
average.
Say it again, I.
And the inspirational rap song that Hampton sings seems a little too corny for kids who listen to hip-hop artist Fetty Wap.
So you guys ready? You're going to help us out?
But I'm wrong. They're excited, and Asaya says she's learning.
That alcohol can make you, like, dehydrated because it's a liquid. I thought it would just, like, make you drunk.
But even just a year from now, these 9- and 10-year-olds may be bored by all this. As children get older, marketing experts say the educators have to change up their tactics. The latest national anti-drug media campaign doesn't include a lot of drug facts or a long list of awful things that can happen if you smoke or drink. In one commercial, you see groups of teenagers at home or at a party. A big, omnipotent hand sweeps in and nudges one of the kids to take a prescription bottle from the medicine cabinet.
Just go do it. Go do it.
Or in another scene, to sip beer from a red plastic cup. And each time that happens, one of the teens pushes back.
If you're not in control, then who is? Live above the influence.
The campaign began back in 2005, and the White House says youth exposed to these above-the-influence messages are less likely to start using marijuana. But sometimes prevention efforts don't work, or worse, they can make kids more curious about drugs. The federal government spent about $1 billion on an older campaign called the Anti-Drug. It was widely considered a failure. Some research suggests that the ads made drug use seem familiar and acceptable.
I don't know why she's tripping. It was only weed. I only tried it once.
You're grounded. That means no phone.
Mom, come on.
Advertising executive Mike Sukel says when it comes to anti-drug and alcohol messages, adolescents and younger teens are more receptive than older teens who've already made up their mind.
The sweet spot was that 12 to 15-year-old.
Sukel Advertising was hired to steer teens away from weed in Colorado. But recreational marijuana is legal for adults in that state, which complicates the prevention message. In Colorado, they decided to tell teens about studies that found that marijuana hurts developing brains. The campaign also fessed up that the research is preliminary, and even the scientists don't know for sure.
And then, you know, asks them, do you want to be a lab rat? Do you want to be, you know, the generation that will prove or disprove this study? And leaves the decision up to them.
Reaching teens on social media like Snapchat and Twitter works. But Sukel says it's almost more important to engage kids by giving them things to interact with and do. The marketing team set up human-sized lab rat cages near a skate park and a library in Denver, then waited for the kids to get curious. In Montana, one anti-meth campaign used scare tactics. The commercial shows skinny meth users with rotting teeth. There are uncomfortable scenes of prostitution, domestic violence, burglary, and this one with two sisters.
Hey, guys. You can do anything you want to me for $50.
Well, what about her?
Sure.
Kathleen Kelly is a professor of marketing at Colorado State University. She says fear tactics work, but the results don't last long. So around prom season, some high schools staged dramatic demonstrations with crashed cars and bleeding, banged-up students to show what can happen if you drive under the influence.
These young people file out of auditoriums and say, I'm never going to do that.
Kelly's expertise is social marketing.
Instead of trying to sell you hamburgers or lip gloss, for example, I use the tools of marketing and I try to unsell or influence certain behaviors.
Scare tactics work for drugs like meth, cocaine, and heroin. But Kelly says fear is not effective for more commonly used drugs like marijuana. 23-year-old Tim Raybolt says when he was in high school, students were told not to drink and drive, and his teachers made the hard stuff sound scary.
That seemed terrifying to do, but everything else seemed perfectly okay. And then there was nothing about prescription pills. So that's like what took off in high school, is that everyone was using pills because they're prescribed by a doctor, so they must be okay. It was kind of the thinking behind that.
Kids would crush up study drugs to pull an all-nighter or lose weight. Raybould is clean and sober now, but says he and lots of his high school classmates mixed medicine and alcohol to party on the weekends.
I honestly think it's just a waste of resources to try and get students and young people to never try drugs. Like, I just don't think that's realistic.
Everybody's doing it. You hear that all the... Oh, really? Everybody's doing it.
Lisa Graham is a prevention educator and says she's not going to stop telling kids to avoid drugs. But she says prevention messages have come a long way since First Lady Nancy Reagan told us all to just say no.
Now it has to be more of a conversation. You can't just preach to the kids and tell them, no, don't do this. You have to be able to explain why they shouldn't do this and, you know, what happens if I do this.
Over the years, working together with health researchers, marketers have modified their message for different populations.
My teacher tells us to just say no.
This ad was designed for inner city kids and to fight the stereotype that poor kids are okay with drugs in their neighborhood.
Because the dealers are scared of police, but they're not scared of me, and they don't take no for an answer.
To Kevin Scott and all the other kids who take the long way home, we hear you. Don't give up.
Health researchers say it's normal for teens to test limits. They're supposed to challenge what adults tell them to do. So given that, today, anti-drug campaigns acknowledge that young people want autonomy and that they have independent goals.
The best way to avoid becoming addicted or abusing drugs is not to use them at all.
Back at the after-school program in Wilmington, Delaware, you can hear the adults reinforcing that message.
Ready? You're created for greatness. You are created for greatness. You are created for greatness.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Bless and live lavish. You created for greatness. You created for greatness. You created for greatness.
Finally, on today's show, we're going to hear a story about addiction and recovery. Before we get to that, a quick note. We did speak to Anne Fletcher. She's written a book about rehab, and she had some really good points on what people should be looking for with addiction treatment. What is good treatment? What helps? You can find that on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. Corey Cohen is 22 years old, and he's very much the face of this heroin epidemic. He grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and he was prescribed opioids after a wrestling injury when he was 17. He became addicted, and eventually he switched to heroin because it was cheaper. I met him at the restaurant where he now works. He's been working in the restaurant industry since he was about 14 years old. And Corey told me that about a year into his addiction, he had dropped out of community college, but he was still able to maintain a job and an apartment.
My thought in my head was, as long as I had my job, nobody could really tell me that I was a full-blown drug addict because I had a full-time job and I had an apartment. So if I had those two things to hold on to, then nobody could tell me that I was anything else than a hard worker and a young kid who lived on his own. I explain addiction as probably the most strenuous and stressful full-time job I've ever had. On top of working 14 hours in the restaurant industry, I was working 24 hours a day to feed my habit, and eventually I ended up getting arrested. I was physically exhausted and just emotionally shut off to everything. It became time to really make a decision whether I wanted to continue using and either end up in jail or in a grave or get sober and try to get this whole legal situation handled correctly and get on and better my life. I decided to stop using like a day or two before I actually moved into the recovery house, and I actually illegally obtained Suboxone, which is a drug that helps with the withdrawal symptoms of opiate addiction. And I took it one day and decided that I shouldn't be doing that. if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. And I just kind of dealt with the sickness that came along with it. I didn't sleep for a good 3 weeks, or at least sleep well. I had terrible stomach aches. I had terrible nausea. It just, I kind of decided that it was going to be my punishment to myself for, I got myself into this situation. I'm going to sit in it and deal with it and come out on the other end. The recovery house that I lived in was for kids in my age range. It's, I believe the age range in the recovery house is 18 to 25, 26. It was nice to have the camaraderie of a bunch of kids my age. We were all there to kind of help each other along the process. I lived there 3 or 4 months.
Can I get some pickles on this? She said hold the pickles. Oh, hold the pickles. Okay.
It was brought to my attention that maybe I have some underlying issues that, such as depression, which was never treated or diagnosed because I was self-medicating myself. So I've been seeing my therapist and seeing a psychiatrist and trying to see if medication is a good choice for me, because I find that when I hit that low point and I'm in a hole of depression, that sometimes my mind will try to trick me, saying the only way that this will be able to get fixed is if I go and I drink or I use or just any way to take myself away from myself. But being a year and a half into my recovery, I know when those signals come up what to do with them and what to do about them. The easiest thing for me to do is to just call someone. It's kind of hard to sneak away and do bad things to myself if I have someone who's holding me accountable, who's sitting right in front of me. The tattoo that's on my chest is a mantra to everyone who I've ever met who's in recovery. It says it's never too late to be what you might have been. I got it when I was 19 in college, thinking I was going to go through college and do the college thing. And it wasn't until getting sober and looking, really being able to look at myself in the mirror, because during my entire addiction, I don't think I ever looked at myself, or like really looked at myself in the mirror. I might have glanced at myself, but like I couldn't look at myself. And hopping out of the shower one day, I might have been like 90 days sober, and I seeing it on my chest, it was like, this is, I got it. Someone somewhere, maybe a higher power, call it God, call it whatever you want, knew that this was going to happen to me, and it's marked on my chest forever that I feel as though I'm becoming the person that I was supposed to be.
Corey Cohen works as a cook in Philadelphia. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Libby Tracy is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. And this week we had additional engineering help from Adam Staniszewski. Paige Flager is our associate producer, Megan Pinto the executive producer, and Joel Patterson is our managing editor. And we want to say congratulations to Joel and his wife, Christina. They just had a baby girl. Next week, we're going to hear about a rare condition that causes some really strange symptoms.
I can hear my eyeballs move. Holy cow. Crazy.
Don't miss that episode. Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.